Good morning. Welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams. People in New Mexico are spending a lot of their income on housing. Renters in Albuquerque are putting more of their paychecks towards rent than people in places like New York or San Francisco. And that's according to a recent State of the Nation's Housing Report from Harvard. But why are people in this state paying so much for a place to live? What does that mean for our economy, for people living in poverty, for the overall housing market? We want to hear from you. Give us a call with your experience as a renter or as a landlord. 277-5866 is the number to call, or toll free at 877-899-5866. Joining us this morning to talk about New Mexico's housing problems are Monica Beda, Senior Policy and Program Advisor at the New Mexico Mortgage Finance Authority, and Felipe Rael, Executive Director of the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership. Welcome.
Thanks, morning. Ed.
Thanks for being here this morning. Well, the Harvard report put Albuquerque at number 8 in the country in terms of the amount of people's income that they spend on rent. So maybe a good place to start, Monica, is with you. When we talk about people spending a lot of their money on housing costs, what exactly does that mean?
Well, Ed, what that means, what an affordable home means, is that you're spending less than 30% of your income on your housing costs, whether that you're a homeowner and that's your mortgage and other costs, or you're a renter and that's your rent and utility costs. So what the Harvard report is looking at is how many people are cost burdened. They're paying 30% or more of their income in rent or housing costs if they're homeowners. And they also look at how many people are paying over 50% of their income on housing costs, and that means you're extremely cost burdened. Now, actually, the ranking, just to be clear, the rankings for cost burden are a little different than the number you're referencing, which is the typical, how much a typical renter in Albuquerque pays, and there we did rank higher. But Albuquerque and a lot of the communities around the state did rank higher than the national average for cost burden for renters. And frankly, that's because our incomes are so low. If you look at our costs, they're actually kind of around the middle of the curve for the nation, but our incomes in this state are extremely low, and that's why you see the skew. It takes into account incomes and the cost you're paying for housing, and our incomes are way at the bottom.
Right, so it's more a question of how much people are earning rather than how much the rent is costing.
That's exactly right.
What's with the 30% number? Is there some magic there in terms of the math? Why does that become a problem when people are spending 30% or more of their income on rent?
Sure, Ed. If you look at just the pie, if you're spending 30% or more of your income on rent, that just leaves a lot less for groceries. If you have any kind of a catastrophic emergency, if you need to take your kid to the doctor, it just doesn't allow that much money left to enjoy the rest of life. So as you do more of that, it's sucking up from those other kind of from those other pots. They won't have enough for groceries if there's a catastrophic event. It just really impacts people's ability to save and get ahead.
Well, Felipe, what about Albuquerque? How do we look here in terms of, Monica was talking a little bit about how we rank in the, you know, in terms of the overall situation, but how would you characterize the housing market in Albuquerque when we're talking about renters and the amount of money that people are paying on rent?
Sure. It's a great question, Ed. I mean, the way to look at it is kind of, and a little bit backwards. Let's talk first about the rental supply. The average apartment in Albuquerque was built in about 1980. These projects are now 35 years old, suffering from a lot of deferred maintenance. The landlord's going to have to start raising rents at some point just to cover his costs, repair things break. It's a business, but nonetheless, he wants a quality place for people to live. Conversely, there's no new supply in kind of that middle market. If you look at it, it's almost like a barbell. That middle market's not being built. There's really no financing for it. There's no financing mechanism.
What do you mean middle market?
So just your folks that could go in and qualify for an apartment right off the street. Nobody's building that product in our marketplace. They're building one of two products. Either your really high-end stuff, think of the stuff right around ABQ Uptown. These are going to be premium rents, premium amenities. There's capital available there to people build that type of product. Conversely, the kind of business that we're in is in the affordable housing sector. This is using usually some type of state or federal resource to build apartment complexes with restricted rents. Those are the only two type of development that's happening in our marketplace. And so it's really kind of stretching that middle market or that typical home renter population, because there's no new supply, no new demand. And it's just causing that impact there.
It's funny because there seems to be a lot of people who need kind of a middle of the road place to live, place to rent. So why is there not more investment in that area?
The economics just aren't there. You've got to, if you look at it like a business, you've got to have enough rents to cover your operations, and these guys are in it for profit. So if there's no profit there, there's not a lot of upside. What we've actually seen is rents increasing dramatically, but folks' incomes have actually been falling over the last 5 years. So that's just, you're just decreasing that population of folks who could potentially be your renter population, but there's just not that product there. Huh. It just doesn't make sense for a developer to come in and do it. The returns just aren't going to be there for them.
I guess there's kind of an incentive to build like a really ritzy, you know, high-end place, because then you're going to get more money if you can fill it up with, you know, people paying more rent. Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting. Well, Monica, we talk a little bit about Albuquerque, but the Harvard report that we were mentioning at the beginning of the show talked about problems with affordability and housing throughout the state. New Mexico is hit particularly hard in terms of availability of affordable housing. Why don't you give us an idea of other parts, you know, statewide? What are we looking at? What's the affordability for renters in New Mexico?
Well, our agency, MFA, works statewide. So when we look at the statewide averages, they don't look quite as bad as when you look at individual communities that have specific issues. Our cost burden for the state as a whole for renters is about 51%, whereas in the nation it's about 49%. So we're a little bit above the average, but we're certainly not in the worst category. But as I was telling you before, Ed, there's really, you know, I would say about four types of communities in New Mexico. We have the Albuquerque metro area, which has very specific conditions to it. We have oil and gas communities where you're seeing a tremendous amount of growth and a lot of problems meeting the housing needs of people all across the spectrum. In this report, it's showing those communities having no cost burden, but we know that's just because census data has not really reflected the extreme growth in those communities yet.
In the oil and gas areas?
Correct. There's so many temporary workers, it's really difficult to count sometimes how many people are needing housing in those areas. So I would say the numbers for southern New Mexico communities are not really reflected properly in this report. Then we have rural parts of the state that are losing population, and it's very difficult to make, as Felipe was kind of alluding to, investments in affordable housing because there's just not population there and our population growth. And then I would say the last category is our high-cost areas. And so you have places like Santa Fe, Taos, Los Alamos, Espanola, which kind of gets wedged in between all of those places and suffers from the high costs. And those areas, with the exception of Santa Fe, have extremely low incomes. And so you'll see in this report, those are the areas that rank the highest in the nation among smaller, they're called micropolitan areas, so small cities. Those rank, the communities I just named, and also Portales and Clovis, are ranking in the top 12 out of 500 micropolitan areas for cost burden. And it's because of low incomes.
Top 12 out of 500. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yep.
This came up recently in Santa Fe and in the Santa Fe Town Council, that there is an affordability problem there, even if incomes are a little bit higher. And it's interesting because we talk about affordable housing and we usually think of things, you know, that are mostly for low income residents, you know, people who need to pay a very small percentage of their income towards rent. But like in a place like Santa Fe, it seems like affordable housing might have a very different definition, or in Taos, because everything is expensive. And, you know, a middle income kind of person is going to have trouble finding a house there. I mean, so when we talk about affordable housing, is there a broader way to look at it than just low income people? I mean, can somebody who's making, you know, $40,000-$50,000 a year in a place like Santa Fe need affordable housing?
Well, I think the way to look at it is that housing affordable for that household? Your income may be high, but if the housing costs are still astronomical, you can't afford it no matter what. So there's just not that, once again, that middle band. I mean, you have things like in the Tierra Contenta neighborhood in Santa Fe where things are that whole subdivision is supposed to be set up as kind of affordable home ownership and affordable renter. So if you're kind of a typical Santa Fe family, you can go there. But that's kind of pushing things to the outskirts. If you're looking still in town in Santa Fe, there's still that need. The median price of housing is still out of reach of the folks making the median income.
And I would just add to that, Ed, that HUD sets, we won't get into this complicated area, but HUD actually sets standards for what incomes are considered low and moderate income and how much people can charge for rents in properties with restricted rental. And so in places like Santa Fe, you'll see the incomes set for to qualify to live in those places are actually higher, because the incomes in Santa Fe are higher. And in Taos, conversely, they'd be lower because the incomes are lower. So HUD does kind of make those adjustments for people based on the median household income in those areas. Also, in Santa Fe, I don't know how many years it's been, but we had a significant, I'd say, kind of influx of affordable housing units that were built maybe about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. Felipe. And so that market is relatively well served. I'm not trying to say they don't need more, but it's relatively better served than, let's say, Taos or Las Vegas or Española especially. So I think there is more more available in the Santa Fe market than in some of these smaller communities.
Well, we want to hear from you. Has paying high rent forced you to cut back on food, healthcare, other important expenses? Do you have ideas on ways out of this predicament? You can call our local number, 277-5866. Our toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@KUNM or post comments to our webpage at KUNM.org. Now, has there been any studies, Monica or Felipe, about the impact, the social impact or the impact on poverty in areas like Española where incomes are so low and housing costs are so expensive?
Yeah, I'm Moises Gonzalez. So I'm an assistant professor at the School of Architecture and Planning. We've been working on a couple studies. One study in particular looks at the region of the Riochama Valley, which is just northwest of Española. One of the things that I'd like to go back to a couple other comments that I think the stressor is really based on the economics in terms of access to jobs and how the economy shifted. If you look at northern New Mexico, look at the federal budget sequester and how that's affected even jobs at Los Alamos National Laboratory, or even jobs at seasonal jobs where you might work as a firefighter or a seasonal worker at, say, the Forest Service. Those have been impacted. So what we're seeing is we're seeing a community that has land assets, but those land assets don't really translate in terms of being able to finance housing. The challenge, what happens is you don't have developers, say, in the Albuquerque area that are developing housing. So what you have is a community that's stressed in terms of older housing stock, which is in traditional communities, where you know it might be the adobe type structure in a compact historic community, where you know maintaining and maybe adding additions or to that structure become challenged because of being able to finance that, but also creating the abilities to finance new housing becomes a challenge.
Well, we're talking about the challenges in paying for housing in New Mexico. Moises, I didn't get a chance to introduce you, but Moises Gonzalez is with us of University of New Mexico, Felipe Rael of the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership, and Monica Abeda of the Mortgage Finance Authority. We're going to take a short break here, then we'll be right back.
Well Woman Radio looks at issues from a woman-centered perspective and maintains that if women are lifted up to achieve their greatest level of health and well-being, they will in turn support their families and communities, and everyone benefits. Join us this Friday morning for Well Woman Radio at 8 a.m. right here on KUNM.
A computer virus that freezes your laptop is one thing. A virus that shuts down a city electric grid is another. And cyber attacks aren't rare events.
It would probably be scary to really know about the true magnitude of the attacks that have been thwarted.
It's What the Hack on the next Big Picture Science. Are you protected?
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. We're back talking about expensive rent, affordable housing, and low incomes in New Mexico. If you want to weigh in or ask a question of our panel, the number is 277-5866, locally in Albuquerque. You can call our toll-free number at 877-899-5866, or you can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is at KUNM News, and our hashtag is HealthNM. We want to hear from you. How do you afford rent in New Mexico? Is this affecting your bottom line? Give us a call. Moises, you were talking a little bit about the situation in northern New Mexico, where you do a lot of research for the Community and Regional Planning Department. Have you looked at this is a very poor area. Can you talk a little bit about the specific impacts that this has, the situation of high rental costs for the people in that area?
Well, before we get into rental costs, I think the difference between, say, a region like Rio Riba County is that you actually have high ownership. And the thing is there's, you know, in terms of the land tenure in those historic land-grant communities, as historic acequia communities, you actually have a lot of heirship property, meaning you have property that went from one generation inherited to the next generation. So the issue is it not necessarily the ability to access land to build a house. It's the issue is access to capital to maybe or finance the construction of a home. I think it's a bigger question that I think both of our other speakers were getting into, which is the economy, right? It's the access to jobs. So when you have a community that doesn't necessarily have access to jobs, the challenge that you have is the ability to finance a home construction or finance maybe in addition to an older structure. So to me, I think in after the recession that hit in 2008, the challenges for northern New Mexico are double-fold, meaning that there's not necessarily access to jobs locally, which was a condition that existed before the recession. But where we are now is you have young families that are growing up that stay in Rio Riba County that don't have access to jobs and are actually leaving the county. And that's actually a statewide condition. You know, we're reaching a point where we're actually having not necessarily population growth in the state. So it's not just affecting Rio Riba County, but it's also affecting the metro area where you just have out-migration as a result. So I think that reflects in maybe what Monica was mentioning in terms of the data. I think the data is actually worse. It's just that some of these conditions can't be tracked necessarily real time, and so that explains a little bit about the condition.
Hmm. Does that fall in line with what you found, Monica?
Absolutely, it's really an economic issue, and it's interesting. You know, the things that Moises are pointing out. We actually rank very high in the nation for the number of homeowners without a mortgage, and that really reflects the the tradition of family inheritance in the state. We're ninth in the nation for that. 43% of homeowners do not have a mortgage. But as he mentioned, you know, the things that we've seen in the metro area, you know, the having to do with the federal sequester and cuts in federal spending are just magnified in these smaller communities because it's even a larger segment of the population that's reliant on the federal economy in northern New Mexico. So, you know, as you have those cuts, it's really affecting everybody, and people are having trouble getting financing. I think the financing is starting to loosen up a little bit, but in the years following the crash, access to capital has been very, very difficult for everyone. And so that has been another major factor that's played into this crisis.
Let's go to the phone lines. Norm is with us from Albuquerque. Hi, Norm. Welcome.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to get away from the aspect of the conversation about landowners or apartment complex owners somehow not making enough money. It's not profitable enough. In my experience, over 15 years of renting in various apartment complexes in Albuquerque, I seem to think that the problem is a lot of complexes have been sold and resold, and I think it's partially greed. Many complexes that I've lived in the last few years have started doing things to nickel and dime us besides our normal rent. For For example, we now have to pay for the batteries in our smoke detectors. We have to pay for air filters on our air conditioning system. We have to pay for keys to get into the pool, and we have to have a tag also to get into the pool. And if we lose those, then those tags and those keys cost $50 each. To me, it's a money-making process for these apartment complexes, and I'm not sure what their intention is other than just to make money. A lot of the amenities that are shown to you when you move into an apartment complex, like pools and office equipment.
Norm, I hear what you're saying. Do you still live in an apartment today?
Or they don't use them, okay? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Are you still living in an apartment today?
Yes.
How are these costs affecting, you know, your quality of life? Are you having trouble? Is this eating into other parts of your budget?
Yes. My rent just recently was raised $35 per month. That's the highest I've ever been raised in my 15 years. The trash cost that they affix to us, the water cost, these are costs that are passed not from the city to the tenant, but the apartment complex, the owners, they get the bill, and they add on a commission or a profit, and then they pass it on to us, and those keep increasing.
Well, I think you bring up a good point, Norman, and I'm not sure if it's motivated by greed. I know the apartment owners also have a bottom line that they have to attend to. And if I'm understanding it right, Felipe, the costs are increasing for people that are running apartments. Is that right?
Sure. I mean, they're not. I mean, the $35, Norm, I understand that's impacting your household acutely. I get that. I understand that. What I'm just trying to explain is the situation there. Their costs are probably increasing more than that. So what they're doing with these things like the RUBS, Resident Utility Billback Program, and adding on their premium on top of that is trying to just cover their overhead expenses and keep the lights on and keep the property nice to attract new tenants. It's just a catch-22 for everything. That landlord would actually like to increase it more. But to predicate that, you would need to be making a lot more money. And we're just not seeing that overall in the economy. I doubt your income. I'm not going to ask you specifically, Norm, but I doubt your income has been increasing dramatically enough to be able to absorb all these costs. And that's where we're hitting the acute problem overall in our marketplace. Yours is a one specific example. I think we could expand that across kind of all the renter population in Albuquerque, and it's just unfortunate.
Well, do you prefer to rent, those of you out there listening, or do you rent because you have to? How do you manage the costs? There's so many questions to get to, and we want to hear from you. So give us a call, 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque, or 877-899-5866 is our toll-free number. Or you can send us an email at callinshow@KUNM.org. Some other callers on the line queued up. Let's go to Gilbert in Santa Fe. Hello, Gilbert.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Doing well, thanks. Go right ahead.
Actually, my question was, and you know, I get really tired of hearing people talking about percentages without giving explanations on where they came up with the percentages. Now, the percentages for rent, and they were talking 30 to 58%, was that net or gross? If it's on gross income, when you tack on the 33% for federal taxes, the percentage for Medicare, if there's any benefit, it can range anywhere from an additional 33 to 48%, which would change the available income for anybody that's renting down drastically. And, you know, I just like some explanation on that.
Want to clarify?
It's on the gross income. It's before the taxes. So it's even more acute if you look at it that way.
Interesting.
And Ed, you know, we're basically talking about a report that's put out by the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, and it's using 2013 census data. So it is a kind of standard data set that's used by, I'm sorry, I know the caller's asking not to be so technical, but these are kind of the standard numbers that are put into these types of things. And you try and keep them apples to apples over the year and over the different researchers that do these things so that we have good comparison data.
I'm glad you brought up that we're looking at 2013 data, which I assume is like the most recent data that we have. But is there a chance that things have changed since this report came out? It's a fresh report, but now we're in 2015.
Well, the mention I made earlier about the oil and gas communities, I mean, this is something we see all the time, is that you look at this data and you know it's just not reflecting what's going on in some of these communities with rapid change. So until we get a new data set, and also, you know, these data sets that are in between the decennial censuses are just like, they're just taking a projection and moving it forward. They're actually not recounting everything. So communities where you have rapid change and sudden change, it's really not going to reflect that until they go out and recount. So, you know, we always at MFA know that these numbers are off for communities like that.
Well, let's go to one more call. Alex is on the phone with us from Albuquerque. Hi, Alex. Welcome.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for calling.
I was actually just calling because, you know, we were doing okay with our rent here in Albuquerque, but then I got pregnant and my husband and I, I had to stop working. And then all of a sudden we realized how hard the cost of rent was on a family when you have a new baby and you're not able to go back to work. And I had a hard time going back to work because my son wouldn't take a bottle and it was a whole feeding issue that he just fed a lot. And I had realized that it was just a lot better for me to try and figure out how for me to stay home. But then we started realizing how much of our rent was our income. And even though, you know, we're in a small two-bedroom apartment, we had a really hard time finding two bedrooms under $700 a month or so. And we found one that worked for us. And then after the cost of utilities and renter's insurance and stuff, it's about $800 or so, $820 for us. And it's about 39% of our income now that we're on one income. And it's been really hard. And it makes, you know, staying home with a new baby really difficult. And so I've just recently starting to go back to work now and in order to afford income. But now that my son is older, a little older, he's a toddler now, it's not as expensive with childcare.
Well, Alex, thanks for sharing that. You know, that's probably something that you're not alone in Albuquerque. Guys, is there any help for people like Alex who are struggling with paying rent with a new family? I mean, what do you do in that situation?
Sure, I can speak. We are with the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership, and we're an affordable housing developer. And what we utilize is some federal and some state resources in our own capital and City of Albuquerque capital. And we provide housing that is affordable for the person that comes in. So the idea is if you're in a certain income band, and once again, we're going to get into the statistics and get bogged down the money. But if you're at a certain income band, the idea is that you're paying no more than 30% of your income, including utilities, to live at our complex. And so we have a couple different complexes across town, and there's many others. Folks like us, there's Yes Housing, there's the Sawmill Community Land Trust, there's also some private developers that do the same type of aspect. But the idea is that those folks that live in our complexes do not pay more than 30% of your rent. The problem is there's just not enough of those units around. We're typically running at 97.5% to 100% occupied with a waiting list. So I think that just proves that there's just a big demand out there for this type of product, but just not enough supply.
If I could just add, is that okay?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
One of the challenges that we see is just a shift in the overall, what we call the housing typology. If you look at like the City of Albuquerque, it's about 70% single family housing. If we look at after World War II, that was the type of housing that was generated and put on the market when you had, you know, over several decades of economic growth in the region. The supply was put on the market, the demand was in terms of the economics, people were able to afford and to get into housing. If we look at the challenges where we are today, there hasn't, you know, the shift in the demand for multifamily housing is there. It's just that the market hasn't caught up. Hopefully after, you know, in terms of where we are, in terms of just the need and the demand, that'll start shifting where we start seeing a shift from where housing developers in terms of build single family houses start putting that investment into multifamily housing. So a lot of that has just been a shift. If we talk about in going back one, two decades or going to the expansion of of Kirtland Air Force Base, there was a need for that labor to supply that multifamily housing. So the new housing realities haven't made up for the market.
We have another Alex on the line that wants to weigh in on a similar issue on housing cooperatives. Alex, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I couldn't believe it. Two Alexes from Albuquerque.
What are the chances?
Back.
Go right.
Okay. I'm sorry, there's a delay.
Is that better? We can come back to you if we need to.
No, this is good.
Okay.
What I wanted to throw out there is Albuquerque has two housing cooperatives. That is an alternative way of getting into home ownership. They were originally built in the 70s under the 1974 HUD Act that Nixon enacted, and it's a way to foster home ownership for moderate income people and sustainable community. Albuquerque has two. One is called Greenbrier Townhouses, and the other one is called Echo Ridge. Now, you buy into the cooperative. You aren't buying your unit. What you're buying is a share in the nonprofit corporation that owns it, and we own it collectively. We have a board of directors. We each vote every year on our election for our board of directors. We serve on committees. We have a community garden, a two-bedroom. We pay a monthly maintenance charge, but it covers any repairs that have to be done in our units. It covers our water, our sewer, our trash. For a two-bedroom, it's $422 a month. For a three-bedroom, it's $535 a month.
And Alex, do you you say we? Are you living in one of these cooperatives?
Yes, yes. I live in the Greenbrier Townhouse Cooperative. It's 160 units on 10 acres.
Is this something, guys, that you've looked at? Cooperative housing is a little new. It's a new concept for me, but maybe that's.
Oh no, it goes way back in the 20s. It's very popular in the East Coast, the Midwest, and the West Coast. It just didn't really catch on out here.
Huh. Monica, Felipe, Moises, do you see that as a potential solution to this affordability problem we're facing?
So going back to the history of housing cooperatives are big, especially like in areas like Boston. I mean, they go back decades, so they're a great model. I think there's a lot of potential where we could leverage that model here, but it takes maybe the Albuquerque Housing Partnership might be or some nonprofits, because one of the things it takes a capacity. You know, what the caller's mentioning is there's a board of directors. There's collaboration. So there's a bit of capacity that has to be built to form this type of organization. Is definitely a great model. We don't have enough of them, but it's something in terms of a solution that I think that housing advocates, affordable housing advocates, need to pay more attention to, because we need to maybe invest in how do you organize these things, how do you train people in terms of organizing these types of organizations, and leveraging capital as a collective as opposed to the individual. They're great models. It's true. The callers are absolutely right that it's a great model, but for some reason they're just not as popular out west than they were in, say, the Northeast.
Are there some specific challenges in the northern parts of the state, I'm sorry, where the home ownership rates are high, but there still seems to be a need for housing?
Well, just some interesting models. I mean, there is challenges because, again, we're dealing with a community. Well, the land use situation is different. So if you take like communities like Rio Riba, Taos, it's also the supply of land. Most of the land is federal land. So if you take, the way the land tenure worked out is the community land grants, a lot of those lands were taken over by the federal government. So you have a lot of historic traditional communities, the Seki-based communities that are sandwiched basically in the irrigated floodplain. So any new development impacts irrigated land. So the couple land grant communities that still own community land grants, community lands, such as the Truchas land grant or the Abiquiú land grant, still set aside land, what they call in traditional terms solatices, where they actually allocate pieces of land for housing. The issue is a lot of that land, a lot of those allocations land up being made up of mobile homes, because again, that same capital issue exists. So I think if we could take that cooperative model and make it not just in terms of the rental process, but how do you leverage that cooperative to actually maybe self-help construction? So we're actually building the units, communities are actually building those units. I think the difference between Northern New Mexico and the Albuquerque metro area is the actual ability to actually finance the construction process, where you know you might have a little bit more capital, and you also have a lot more access to builders here. So that's a big challenge for Northern New Mexico.
Well, you're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show live from the University of New Mexico. We're talking about the hard time people have finding affordable places to live in New Mexico. And we want to hear from you. How do you afford to rent in this state? Are you a student that's looking for a new home, dealing with student debt? Especially like to hear from those of you in Española or Taos. If you want to weigh in on the conversation, the number to call is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll-free number to call, 877-899-5866. Send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org or tweet at us at KUNM News. You can use the hashtag HealthNM. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back to take more calls.
Maybe just once in your entire life you have a car or a truck or tractor or RV that you want to get rid of. Maybe it has body damage. Maybe it doesn't run anymore. Maybe it's not worth fixing up and not worth much as a trade, or the driver can't drive it anymore. Anywhere in New Mexico, or even if it's parked in another state, we can pick it up wherever it is. You'll get a KUNM membership and a tax deduction. Just call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
This week in This American Life, Sarah was in a car wreck and went into a coma with a traumatic brain injury. And when she came to, she had trouble remembering the years before her accident. Big stuff, like divorcing her husband.
The doctors said, you don't want to create any more trauma with her. And so if she's indicating that she thinks that she's still married, you can't just drop that bomb on her.
That's this week.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, KUNM Reporting Project, providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. We're talking high rent and challenges in the housing market. Give us a call to weigh in. Our local number is 277-5866. Toll-free, 877-899-5866. Send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage at kunm.org. Let's go back to the phone lines. Alan is on the phone with us from Albuquerque with a question about Social Security. Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Yeah, I'm 70 years old and unfortunately must survive on SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which finally is $733 a month. Every time we get a cost of living increase in the number of dollars to equal the buying power we had the year before, they raise our rent. I'm in a HUD-assisted unit, which is really, really hard to find. It's not a voucher. You have to move. You have to go find a place that's already has assigned units to HUD that have been inspected and are okayed and so on. And they're very, very scarce. There's like a year, 2 years, 5 years waiting list. I can't move, in other words. And I didn't know that the place was infested with mold. J.L. Gray keeps not providing air filters that they're supposed to do every month. The same for the battery smoke detectors, et cetera, et cetera. Their maintenance is terrible. Yeah. And properties all over the state.
Alan, is this something that you hear a lot of, you know, with your friends that are of the same age group that are on SSI? I mean, is this a common problem for you and the people that you know?
Yes, we keep losing income.
How do you deal with that? I mean, what do you do to adjust when you're losing your income?
I drive less and pray that my car isn't going to need any expensive repairs.
Well, what do you guys think about that, Monica or Felipe or Moises? That's not a trivial situation that Alan's talking about, a very serious one. Is there a way out of that? Potential solutions for fixing this problem for people like Alan?
Sure. I mean, I kind of see two issues there, Alan, and we can tackle them independently. The first is just the state of your housing. I don't know exactly which complex you're just speaking of, but most of these HUD-assisted housings were built between 1965 and 1985. They have a ton of deferred maintenance. Once again, I'm not defending J.L. Gray here, but what I'm saying is that J.L. Gray's got to keep the lights on and keep it as good as a project. And those costs that they're increasing are probably set by some statute, and it's probably not in covering all of their costs that they really need to do to cover all the deferred maintenance, repair the mold issues, whatever else needs to be done to kind of improve the property. And then once again, we can talk about the second part of the issue, and that's folks on fixed incomes. Their fixed incomes are staying flat and increasing nominally, but it really sounds like it's not really covering your true cost of living increases every year. Groceries are ridiculous. I went in and bought oranges the other day. I'd never seen the highest cost of oranges that I've ever seen. I actually put the things back down. You compound that with gas, your vehicle, everything else. Is your income is staying relatively flat, and your rental increase as a percentage of what your household budget is, it's just going to impact everything all over the board. And I don't think you're alone, Alan, and that's really unfortunate in our community.
And I would just add to that, you know, we know that probably a large majority of renters have these issues, and we know that people are really squeezed. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the funding for these programs comes from the federal government, and we are just not seeing any increases in that funding. We're, in fact, seeing a movement away from that. And with the budget caps that were put in place in 2011, we're just seeing, you know, we're having a difficult time keeping pace even with what's out there, much less putting new affordable housing out on the street. And, you know, the major finding from this Harvard study, and Moises already referred to this, is that there's been a huge shift between home ownership and rentership. There have been a lot more people moving into the rental market, and part of that is because of the economic crisis that we went through. But, you know, in New Mexico, our homeownership rate has changed about 3.5% since 2006, and on the national average, about 5%. So when you have this many people flooding into the rental market, you have cuts in federal spending, less money for affordable housing, you know, everybody is getting squeezed, and, you know, the last person that shows up with is the renter themselves. And so it's a really dire situation, difficult situation. We obviously are constantly advocating for more funding for these programs because we know the need in New Mexico is so great and the incomes are so low. But frankly, there hasn't been a real, you know, great solution for that.
If I could add, I'd like to add to Monica's comment about just in terms of the supply. One of the things is we haven't seen developers make the shift into, there's been some developers, you know, making a shift to higher density housing types, but it's not keeping up with the market. One of the things that I think that we should really look at as what other cities have done is if we're a city of 70% single family housing, we're not allowing our city to evolve. I think if, you know, somehow planners had the idea in the 1940s to give you a 25-20 foot setback in the front of your house or on the 20 foot setback in the rear of your house. Maybe what we should look at is allowing auxiliary units. The way Austin, Texas addressed some of their affordable housing area issues around the University of Texas was to allow auxiliary units. So maybe if we allowed in certain parts of the cities where, you know, we maybe allow auxiliary units where instead of a backyard, you have an auxiliary housing unit to the front yard, you have an auxiliary unit.
What do you mean? Explain what you mean.
Instead of having, say, in the backyard and more in more of the urban areas of Albuquerque where you have a typical lot is maybe 50 foot wide, 100 foot in depth, and then you have a 25, 30 foot setback from the front of the house.
Right, a big yard.
Yeah. So maybe if we allow maybe people to maybe take advantage of supplying housing in the back part of their house or even the front part of their house in the more urban context of the city, we would create more opportunities. We just can't keep up the supply. Developers aren't going to do it. We may need to look at parts of the city where we allow more allowable density to make up for
multifamily housing in areas that were single family housing. We just have to allow our city to evolve.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I know this was an issue before the city council recently, and those of us in affordable housing are just going, why not? You know, why is this controversial? I mean, people can already do accessory dwelling units under certain circumstances. I mean, why not open that up to people who need this housing? And, you know, other progressive cities in the nation are doing it. We should absolutely be doing it. The big change that's happened over the past few years is that a lot of single family homes have converted to rental units. And I think people are unaware of that fact. But our housing market would not have been as, you know, relatively stable as it was if that wouldn't have happened. We would have had a much greater outbreak of foreclosures during the crisis and vacant homes. And because these units have converted to rentals, it's actually been a stabilizing factor. So I think we need to really, that's something that we can do, and it's a pretty easy fix.
Let's go to Logan, who's on the line with us, calling from Albuquerque. Logan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
What's your question?
So I kind of had a question if you kind of knew any statistics about, like, the demand for rent in New Mexico coming up, if you knew anything about the number of that, and then just a quick comment after that.
Sure. The demand for rent statewide, you mean?
Yes.
Monica, do you have those numbers?
The demand for rental units?
For rental units.
Has it been increasing at all, or is it kind of steady? Or
yes, it's absolutely been increasing, and I think one of the issues we're talking about here is because we have a high number of low-income people. We have, if you look at our distribution compared to other cities and other states, we have a lot of people making under $15,000 a year, a lot of households. Those are people basically earning minimum wage. The housing in that sector is very limited. And someone called in earlier who, you know, was using Section 8. I mean, it's actually difficult to find apartments and, you know, and I couldn't tell you an exact number, but we know that there are long wait lists for everything in that area. I don't know about the demand in the, you know, the other parts of the market.
Well, it kind of makes sense why the rent prices would be increasing as far as maintenance goes and the demand for them. It's just because they can charge it. And that brings me back to the kind of thing that we really need to have a focus on, like a economic development and creating jobs. Because when we create jobs and lasting prosperity for everyone, then it makes it easier for other people to get into homes and kind of to balance out the rental market. And another kind of comment I had was too, the host kind of made a comment about the kind of the barbell effect, how there's a big focus on like a higher income as far as rent development goes for housing for that, and then on low income. But I kind of had a thought about if there's going to be a lot of government assistance towards like a lower end development stuff like that, and more incentive for builders to kind of like cater to the either lower class, which is understandable, like they need a hand too, but like, right. As far as the government assistance, it maybe be nice to have like assistance programs to help developers create like a rental areas and things like that for like the middle class. The working class, and we need a hand too sometimes. So,
well, again, thanks for your call, and all three of our panelists were nodding their heads along with you when you were talking about the need for jobs and some help there for our working class people. We do have an email question along the same lines as Logan's listener emailing in saying, "Are there policies that counties or cities could adopt that would help address these issues? Do you guys have specific policies in mind that you think could really help this discrepancy between income and rental costs in terms of counties and cities?"
I think that Moises just mentioned some of those about the accessory dwellings.
About the accessory dwellings, okay.
We work with communities all the time in advising them to allow multifamily rentals as permitted uses in certain zones. A lot of communities, especially in rural parts of the state, you have to go through a longer entitlement process to get those approved. And we always recommend that a community should have that online and available to developers so they can meet their housing needs. We work with communities very specifically to address different needs. So there's a number of other solutions. But some of the things Moises mentioned, you know, eliminating or reducing setbacks, you know, just kind of some smart development options that help make more land available for affordable housing.
Let's go to one more caller. Erica, you're on the line calling from Albuquerque.
This is John.
John, I'm sorry. Hi, John.
The comment I'd like to make revolves around mostly the rural parts of the state. We've gotten into this nasty, vicious cycle that somehow people believe that a mobile home is affordable housing, when in fact it's the most expensive form of housing because it makes the person ultimately poor. And it also makes the community poor, which leads to this vicious cycle of people not having enough income to pay rent or a mortgage. And that is, it depletes a small town of its skilled tradespeople that otherwise would have been used and involved in building a house. And the thing that is upsetting to me is that if we want to help people in smaller communities find affordable housing, then we need to get away from this idea that we want affordable housing to be just add water and mix. Affordable housing has to be something that's sustainable and adds wealth. And if people don't have wealth, then they're not going to be able to have any kind of housing, no matter if it's rental or if they own it. And my concern is that we are sucking the energy out of our small communities, and the skilled tradespeople that need to live there to support a stronger economy by, you know, considering things like mobile homes, affordable housing, when in fact all the labor that goes into making that is maybe two or three states away. And so I just wanted to kind of point that out here, the commentary of your staff. What are we doing to provide meaningful avenues for construction to occur and not rely on just add water housing, which is ultimately the poorest and wealth-depleting type of housing there is?
Thanks for your call, John. Moises, do you have a take on that, since you're looking a lot at the rural areas?
Yes, it's a huge problem. If we look at any county, my research is primarily in northern New Mexico, but if you look at any county in northern New Mexico, and if you went to the county, pull up the building permits, the majority of those building permits would be for manufactured housing. So the caller is absolutely correct. We haven't come up with a solution. Sorry to say, one of the things that we've looked at is how can going back to the housing cooperative model, or leveraging institutions that could create abilities to be able to allow for maybe financing alternatives. Because one is, there's a couple things. It's not just, it's the financing, right? The way the inheritance structure works is, say if you live in the Santa Cruz Valley. Your family has 4 acres. The family has two or three, maybe children. They allocate a piece of land for each child. Being that most of that private farmland might be in the irrigated land, one of the problems that you immediately run into is being in a floodplain. Well, to do the site-built construction, the actual financing gets really difficult. So it's easier to just, you know, raise up that house, get a permit from the local planning office, build it on blocks, and you can finance the mobile home. You won't get financing in a floodplain for manufactured housing. One of the things we need to look at is maybe working with the federal government of where you have communities that are landlocked, and how do you maybe do set land outside of the floodplain and maybe do planned communities. So the kind of relationships and partnerships to solve the problem in northern New Mexico are going to be complex, but they just take a lot more planning and collaboration between agencies. But it's something that's not just easily fixable, being that the majority of the developable land is in a floodplain. So that's another constraint. So there's other constraints that besides the capital, I think we all agree economic development would be the silver bullet in New Mexico, but there are other constraints as well.
And I imagine one of those constraints is the fact that there's not much infrastructure out there. So how do you get investment for affordable housing when there's not the infrastructure to put in to the electricity grid? Or
infrastructure is a major issue, where you have maybe families that have irrigated land, and you're talking about developing, pulling infrastructure over a larger expanse of territory. If you had cluster development, then you would be able to make efficiency of infrastructure, so just electricity, sewer, water, where you might be take advantage of a shared well as opposed to individual well, become a challenge.
Well, I want to thank all of you, our guests, Monica Aveda of the Mortgage Finance Authority, Moises Gonzalez of UNM Community and Regional Planning, and Felipe Rael of the Greater Albuquerque Housing Partnership. We're out of time, but if you missed part of this program or want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, kunm.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Jefferson White was our engineer today. Kaveh Movahed manages our phones. And Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Find more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for listening.